Hello and welcome to the Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're asking, when it comes to bellwether measures of a country's economy, is GDP still fit for purpose? Is this tool for measuring countries' economic growth still the right one for the 21st century? There are a number of problems and deficiencies that critics are quick to identify. Markets are often quick to fix on the first reading of the gauge, but can disregard or ignore later revisions, which often tell a very different story about the health of an economy. Plus, does the data itself fail to capture important new trends? We'll consider these challenges, and of course, we'll ask our experts. If GDP stats are no longer the right way to measure growth, then what are the alternatives? We start with Brian Rose, US economist for the CIO group within Wealth Management at UBS. We ask Brian, GDP growth is still regarded as a bellwether measure of the success or failure of a country's economy. But as a tool for measuring growth, is it still the right one?
In a lot of ways, I think it's not that useful anymore, and I've joked a lot that we'd be better off if they just stopped announcing it. So you can imagine if they just stopped releasing GDP data, what would you do? What would governments do? And they'd have to focus on things that might actually matter more, both in terms of how well the economy is doing, you know, how well the economy is serving the population, and also in terms of economic policy, the decisions by the central bank, say. And you can sort of see that already in terms of the Fed's policy. They don't focus a lot on GDP. They kind of mention it, but they're more focused on things like inflation, what's going on in the labor market than they are as to, you know, what the GDP growth rate was last quarter.
Matthew Carter is cross-asset strategist in UBS Wealth Management's Chief Investment Office. Matthew explains that when it comes to the utility of GDP, there are pros and cons.
GDP, like many economic indicators, has its pros and cons. And I suppose that one of the pros really still for GDP accounting is that it's a fairly straightforward figure for non-economists, for the public, for policymakers to sort of understand. But a lot of the challenges and the sort of headwinds that GDP is facing as a true test of the strength of an economy come about because we're seeing a number of changes in the way that the global economy is working, a number of innovations that are taking sort of place at breakneck speeds. And put simply, GDP data potentially can't keep up with some of these innovations. And I think a second issue as well that's particularly come to the fore recently from a political standpoint is that for a lot of people, GDP is perhaps conflated or confused with economic well-being. And effectively, GDP might give you a sense of how an economy is growing on the production side, but it doesn't necessarily give you the best indication of whether that is good growth, whether growth is being sort of spread equitably between people, whether people, the electorate, are sort of happy with the state of the economy. And ultimately, for many of the world's policymakers, which obviously want to, particularly if they're politicians, obviously win elections and get a mandate, and a conflation between growth and actual well-being can be sort of potentially harmful, potentially dangerous, and in some instances, as we've seen recently, potentially lead to a rise of more populist policies if people believe that actually growth is not reflecting their own economic, their own social well-being.
Sebastian Salek from Bloomberg here in London summarises his view on the problems with GDP.
For a start, you have the distinction between real GDP and nominal GDP, the former being the latter with inflation taken out of the equation. So it is real GDP, the version without inflation, that is used as the benchmark. But there are many issues, one being its timeliness. It's only published in most countries every quarter. And by the time that's out, the data is old news. So for investors looking to make up-to-the-minute decisions and having a up-to-the-minute snapshot of a country's economy, it's not going to give you the information you need. You're going to need other measures that are a little bit more timely to do that.
Does Dean Turner, economist and director in the UBS UK CIO, think that GDP remains the right tool for measuring growth? Does he have any specific concerns?
The concept of GDP is clearly something that dates back to the early part of the last century. And the industries that were prevalent then were made the calculation of GDP quite simple. But in today's world, where the industries have changed. The ability of statisticians to capture changes is much more difficult these days. And also there is this wider problem of what does it actually represent? Is it really a measure of economic well-being or populations within any economy? And I think that really is open to question.
What the purpose of GDP is remains the key question. That's according to Ricardo Garcia, European economist in UBS CIO Wealth Management.
There are alternative measures how to measure welfare and well-being. There are, for example, happiness indicators also used, but in the current capitalist world, gross domestic product is still the main indicator. Nonetheless, there are a lot of issues on how to measure today's much more complex and partially virtual economy, right?
One commonly cited weakness with GDP calculations is that markets are rather prone to fix on the first reading of the gauge, but disregard or ignore later revisions, which may tell a very different story about an economy's health. And these can be big adjustments. Just look at the UK, for example, says Dean Turner.
The first estimate of GDP, to take the UK example, only around 40% of the data in the first estimate is hard data. The rest is estimated via various models. And when we get the subsequent revisions, we often find out that not only were the initial estimates incorrect, so sometimes to a large margin, other times to a lesser extent, but it's also the underlying components of those estimates that's really crucial. So, for example, the first estimate really gives us a broad overview of what demand in key sectors looks like, but that gives us very little clue on a number of other issues that affects the populations within countries, and in particular, this concept of nominal GDP that actually takes into account the inflationary impact that goes on. And we only tend to find those out much later on in the cycle, and they do often get ignored because this essentially becomes past data.
Ricardo Garcia identifies some similar issues when it comes to the picture in the Eurozone.
The Eurozone, Eurostat has changed its approach and is now issuing, so to speak, a first estimate of the first estimate. And the idea behind that was to catch up with the US, which used to come out a few weeks before the Eurozone GDP numbers. And having said that, the problem is that at that time, most or quite a good part of the hard data in the economy is not even available. So the volatility of GDP estimates will increase certainly in the future.
Matthew Carter too suggests that while there are other more pressing challenges, which we'll come on to, this issue of revisions is nevertheless potentially highly significant.
Those revisions can be quite big. I mean, there's been research undertaken by the OECD that suggests that between 1994 and 2013, for the group of seven largest economies in the world, that average revisions to quarterly GDP growth figures 3 years after you get that first preliminary tentative data point have actually tended to increase the recorded rate of growth by what sounds like a small figure, between 0 and 0.1%. But when you aggregate that over time, it can make a meaningful difference to the overall size of the economy. But some of the issues to do with this are effectively sort of age-old lies, damn lies and statistics problems. It could be that you decide to do something called rebasing, where you choose a different sort of yardstick year for your calculations. And that might lead to different growth figures on the one hand, but if you're rebasing to a more recent year that more fully reflects how an economy has changed, let's say that you're an emerging economy and over the past 10 years you've shifted from being agriculture-based to more manufacturing to more services, yes, your growth figures might be revised, but if they're giving you a clearer sense of how your underlying economy has evolved, then that is a good thing. And the second reason, of course, as to why you might see revisions is simply that the guys who are crunching the numbers, the statisticians, are simply coming up with better ways of actually measuring growth.
Another key criticism of GDP is that the data fails to capture important new trends, whether they be the value of the sharing economy, the impact of an increasingly globalised world, and so on. This is an issue, says Ricardo Garcia, but remember, this has been the case for generations.
Just taking a big step back, for example, at the advent of the car industry over 100 years ago, it took a long time until it was properly reflected in GDP accounts. And we have the same situation today with the virtual economy. You also mentioned the sharing economy, where intellectuals and GDP specialists are still thinking about how to properly account for that.
Does GDP data fail to capture new trends and have a broader problem moving with the times? Here's Sebastian Salek again.
If you look at, for example, the changes in quality and the sort of goods that are included, it doesn't really keep up with that, because as time moves on, technology improves, goods get better and better. But because they cost the same, that economic impact isn't felt within that overall figure. We're looking at sort of the sort of electronics we use today, DVD players, smartphones, iPads, all the rest of it. That development isn't taken into account. In addition to that, there are lots of other measures that aren't felt at all. Sort of the human cost of it, the leisure time that we spend, which is a huge part of our lives, but isn't included in this measure. Furthermore, the underground economy, lots of exchanges happen that aren't included because they can't be recorded. For example, if you're talking about illegal activity, the drugs trade, for example, huge part of the economy that isn't reflected in GDP. And even things that are legal, we're looking at, maybe cash in hand transactions for some building work, for example, perfectly legal, but not if you're not going to declare those taxes. And if you don't declare them, they can't be measured.
The growth of service industries presents other challenges to the status quo, as Dean Turner explains.
Another factor that we're clearly seeing within recent releases of GDP, and when I say recent, I say over the last few years, is the concept of business investment. One of the things that's very prevalent in a lot of service industries is, for example, the concept of bring your own device. Now, that on its own would essentially doesn't mean that on the whole economy level that investment in, say, IT equipment has fallen, but certainly from a business investment side it may have fallen, whereas from a domestic consumption side it would have increased. But capturing that crossover, as an example, is one area where the traditional ways of calculating GDP may be underestimating the real trends.
It's important to bear in mind that GDP was always a measure of economic activity first and foremost, rather than lifestyle or well-being. Here's Brian Rose.
GDP was never meant to be used as a measure of lifestyle or how rich people are. It was always a measure of economic activity, but you include the negative things like running jails, or if you put a lot of locks on your house because there's so many robberies, or people are buying loads of guns. So you can have all sorts of things which are negative for lifestyle, but add to the GDP. So really you have both problems at the same time. There's measurement problems, and also there's just the fact that GDP is not really a measure of lifestyle.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look in more detail at the idea that stems from what Brian was describing there, that there are maybe other potential indices that could reflect the true state of a country's economy more accurately. We've spent the programme so far asking our global experts whether GDP stats are still the right way to measure growth. There have been plenty of reasons raised so far why not. So, if not, what are the alternatives? It's a tricky question and opinion is divided, says Matthew Carter.
There have been a number of sort of high-level suggestions that have recently been given in terms of how we can better measure growth and better measure sort of well-being. One is potentially to actually invest more at looking in sort of the bigger technological changes. This is something suggested by Sir Charles Bean, former policymaker with the Bank of England, in terms of investing money in research units that look at how technology and technological developments like big data, like extreme connectivity and automation can be better understood by economists. So the simple answer there is you invest in better statistics, you invest in people to crunch the numbers and actually invest in ways to actually better get a sense of the underlying economic activity. I think a second thing as well is that perhaps the investment community and policymakers have to shift their mindset a bit and become a little less focused, a little less myopic on GDP alone. Economists like Joseph Stiglitz have suggested, well, let's look at a dashboard of measures. So it's not just GDP, but it's gauges and measures of, for example, sustainability.
And from GDP to gross national product, perhaps. That's one idea from Ricardo Garcia.
If the purpose would remain the same. An alternative would be gross national product rather than gross domestic product. What is the difference? Gross national product measures the output of all nationals, which is different from gross domestic product, which just measures the output generated within the country's borders, regardless of whether these were nationals or not. And when looking at more or less traditional indicators like happiness indicators, some countries have actually adopted. It really depends also on the culture of the country. And as I said, in the Western countries, really capitalist culture still dominates. And that's why for the time being, these alternative measures will have a hard time.
So what of these themes, like well-being, quality of life, a particular preoccupation of Monocle since our inception, sustainability, the environment, health? Will issues like these, or metrics that deal with them, gain equal prominence to GDP as a measure of economic strength? Well, at the very least, you can guarantee that these measures of aggregate well-being are here to stay, says Matthew Carter.
Regardless of whether we want it to have that more prominence, I think that to a certain extent it might become necessary for us to focus more on these broader measures of the aggregate well-being of people within the economy. There are a number of trends to do with globalization and technology that may mean, coupled with constrained budgets for many governments around the world, that they actually have to focus for political reasons on actually more on the well-being side than growth. If you take a few examples, we've seen growing pushback in many of the major economies, many of the major political economies against big trends like, say, globalization, the replacement of, say, manufacturing jobs with ever more automation, and indeed increasingly porous borders that mean that people who maybe have one set of slightly outdated skills are now having to compete with people or with machines from across the world. And to a certain extent, if you're a policymaker who's constrained in terms of how much you can spend at the government level because your fiscal finances are pretty tight or you've got high debt levels, then actually shifting that political agenda potentially away from what can we do to exclusively boost economic growth and more towards what can we do potentially on the seemingly softer side of actually boosting economic welfare may be something that with constrained government budgets, a world of low growth and low interest rates that policymakers have to move to out of necessity rather than out of desire.
Does Dean Turner think that these alternate measures will get equal prominence? Well, not just yet, he cautions.
In all honesty, I think we are still some way from that. I think that these surveys, etc., will have to be conducted for some time yet, and then once we have a bit of a time series and track record for these surveys, perhaps they will start to gain more prevalence in wider thinking, especially if they can be proved to be reliable. But the problem is at the moment is that these are all very new thoughts and very new techniques, so they will continue to be treated with some degree of scepticism until they can establish themselves as something credible.
These other metrics are and will remain valuable. Valued but as separate indices rather than joining or replacing GDP in importance, thinks Sebastian Salek.
GDP is used by investors who their primary aim is to make money. They live within a capitalist world. And when that's not going to help them further their goals, they're not going to take it into account necessarily. So these are important indexes. And indeed, you know, I mentioned one, the Fordham, plenty others popping up. We're looking at the GPI, the Genuine Progress Indicator. That looks at volunteer work. That looks at household work. Puts a value on the household work that currently isn't seen to have an economic benefit. But of course, behind the scenes does, because it allows a household to operate in a way it may not otherwise be able to. So these indexes exist, and whether they thrive in the future, it's difficult to say, but I can't see them being incorporated into GDP anytime soon, because it is rather a cold reading of a country's economic prosperity rather than anything else.
And that's Sebastian Salek, bringing us to the end of this 95th edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance every week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via iTunes, SoundCloud or your preferred platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.